Part 3 of 6 from set number 3001, Alchemy Past and Present, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Alchemy and Healing, the Medical System of Paracelsus.
This evening we will address ourselves to an other, albeit earlier, great and unusual representative of the alchemical tradition, Paracelsus. Last week we spoke about C.G. Jung, and it's probably not without some good reason that, at least in some European circles, Jung was frequently referred to as the new Paracelsus. Jung himself thought very highly of Paracelsus, and on some significant anniversary of Paracelsus, I forget now how many hundreds of years, Jung delivered the memorial lecture on Paracelsus at the Swiss location of Einsiedeln, where in the Benedictine monastery Paracelsus was raised, because his father was working there at the time, because Paracelsus was also Swiss and in his own time often referred to as the Swiss Hermes. In fact, I'll start with a little quotation about Paracelsus by Jung. In his foreword to Paracelsus' selected writings, edited by Yolande Jacobi, Jung wrote about Paracelsus, a contradictory and controversial figure, Paracelsus cannot be brought into line with any stereotype. Paracelsus remains a paradox. He is a true mirror of his century, which even at this late date presents many unsolved mysteries. One of the reasons that in this little series of ruminations about alchemy, which we are doing here, I decided to include Paracelsus is because I wanted to show you what varied effects, let's say, the discipline of alchemy had, what areas of human endeavor have been touched by alchemy and influenced by it. We indicated, I think, on the last occasion that the byproducts, what contemporary lingo would probably call the spin-offs of alchemy, were extremely numerous. And even as in our own age we profit by way of computer technology and all sorts of probably more complex technologies than I care to remember from space research, all of these having been initially developed in connection with space travel, then have become part of our lives. So alchemy had many, many byproducts which became extremely important in many different fields. I well remember from the days of my childhood that at least at that time, that would be in the 30s and in the 40s, one of the major chemical companies, primarily of pharmaceutical chemistry in Hungary, was called the Paracelsus Corporation. So that's how they still remember Paracelsus. Paracelsus, to give him his full name, I always pride myself that even with my probably increasingly failing memory, I can still remember his name, Philippus Aureolus Theophrastus Paracelsus Bombastus of Hohenheim, was born at the very end of the 15th century in 1491 in Switzerland, in Einsiedeln, son of a physician, and he became a physician himself. And his father at that time was attached, I guess, as a physician to the Benedictine monastery there. In the course of his life, our hero accumulated many names. These many names which I've just enumerated were not all his birth names, but he sort of picked them up along the way. For instance, Paracelsus means greater than Celsus. Celsus having been an early Greco-Roman author on medicine. Hippocrates, Galenius, and Celsus were sort of the ancient teachers of medicine, and so someone said that this man was greater than Celsus, so they called him Paracelsus. He studied with his father, and later at age 16, he entered the University of Basel in Switzerland, but was not altogether enthusiastic about his teachers, which is not an uncommon experience with great people. I am certainly not one against schools, and I feel that nowadays people learn far too little in schools, but it is also true that some of the greatest people in history have done singularly badly in school. Winston Churchill being a good example, and many others. Often when the pupil is too brilliant, he can see through the inadequacies of his professors, and if he also has a certain temerity, which Paracelsus undoubtedly possessed, then he lets his professors know that he sees through their inadequacies, and professors to whom their inadequacies are pointed out are hardly ever very happy campers, and they in turn then visit their ire on the students. Mr. Manley Hall of blessed memory, in his really lovely little book, Pathways of Philosophy, which has sort of synopses of the biographies and the teachings of a number of outstanding people, you might want to avail yourselves of them sometimes. One of the loveliest things I think that Mr. Hall ever wrote in his chapter on Paracelsus writes, I'll give you a few quotations as they become appropriate. When Paracelsus was about 16, he entered the University of Basel in the, I think now would be the French part of Switzerland, although still a lot of German there. Here his worst fears were realized. The scholastics were immersed in their own conceits. They were not only ignorant, but blissfully ignorant of their own ignorance. It was at Basel that Paracelsus broke from the traditional practice of medicine. Years later, he described his useful decision in these words. Now it's Mr. Hall quoting Paracelsus himself. I had in the beginning, just as much as my opponents, thrown myself with fervent zeal on the teachers. But when I saw that nothing resulted from their practice but killing, death, murdering, laming and distorting, that the greatest number of complaints were deemed by them incurable, and that they scarcely administered anything but syrups, laxatives, purgatives, oatmeal gruel, pumpkins, citrons, jalap, and other such messes, with everlasting clisters, that is a more classical word for an enema, incidentally, I determined to abandon such a miserable art and seek truth by some other way. The outspokenness of Paracelsus is quite evident here. He became a disciple of other famous alchemist, the abbot Johannes Trithemius of Spondheim in Germany, and then Paracelsus went to the Tyrol to study mining in silver mines owned by the famous Fugger family, who were early mine owners and bankers. And there he decided to examine all arts and sciences firsthand. It is also needful to keep in mind and to state perhaps at this point and then restate all along that the central orientation, the central dedication of Paracelsus was always to alchemy. His other interests, which were very numerous, but let's say primarily medicine and various other interests, all centered around alchemy. Because alchemy, to a lot of these people, certainly in the 16th century, when he lived in the early part of the 16th century, was much more than just a specialty. In fact, in those days, for a variety of reasons, there were not too many specialties in terms of study. One of the reasons for that, which everybody will tell you encyclopedically and otherwise, is that the field of available knowledge was certainly much smaller than our own. And so people could still aspire to, and to some degree acquire a fair amount of universal knowledge. It was possible for a very intellectually very ambitious person to pretty much learn and get to know all there was available of knowledge. That certainly is impossible today. But on the other hand, there was also a little more esoteric reason, I think, for the much more universalized and generalized scholastic dedications of people at that time. And there I think we find the fact that people did not wish to learn things merely in order to acquire some specific skill. Very few people of the upper echelons of learning would want to become narrow specialists and technicians in some area of knowledge. But they looked at the various disciplines of learning and indeed of practice, such as alchemy, really as entry points into something more than specialized knowledge. They looked upon these disciplines as openings into something greater, into a greater world of understanding. And frequently, at least those who were interested in alchemy, called this natural philosophy, and by other names. But whatever they called it, it was a philosophy of life. And perhaps more than that, a philosophy that would include divine things, spiritual things, and human things, as well as perhaps knowledge about the so-called and perhaps miscalled inanimate nature. And that was certainly true of Paracelsus. So the basic matrix of his thinking, the master model around which all of his other interests and skills organized themselves and constellated themselves, was the alchemical model, as we will see. So when he, totally unlike other scholars and physicians, actually deigned to go down into the bowels of the earth, into the silver mines in the Tyrolean Alps and places like that, he did that also primarily with an alchemical justification. Speak about narrow specialties, you need to remember that physicians, doctors, in those days, 16th century, 17th century, clear into the 18th century, for instance, were so high and mighty that they wouldn't even condescend to surgery. They wouldn't operate. Operations appertained to barbers. Barbers would shave people and cut their hair and also cut their limbs off when they became gangrenous or things of that sort. They would engage in bloodletting. Anything that involved cutting the body, they handed it to the barber because he had a razor. He knew how to do these things. And so doctors were very standoffish when it came to having actually contact with the body. And for a doctor to actually go down into the mines and study the ailments and the health conditions, for instance, of the miners, which is what Paracelsus did, was literally unheard of. Now, why did Paracelsus go to the mines? Well, for one thing, the alchemists, of course, had an interesting relationship with metals that were found in the earth. Their theory was that transformation, along somewhat alchemical lines, went on in nature to a certain extent, particularly in connection with metals and crystals. Only the transformation that nature subjects metals and crystals to, so the alchemists felt, was much, much slower than the transformation of the alchemist. So they said, for instance, and not entirely incorrectly, that carbon, coal, would transform itself into a diamond. And of course, diamond is a particular form of carbon, but that it would take a tremendous length of time. for that to happen. That the precious stones and precious metals like silver and gold would sort of grow in the earth, but over a very, very long period of time. And that if you observed what went on in the bowels of the earth, you could draw some conclusions as to how you as an alchemist could do the same thing, but much, much faster. And Paracelsus also noted, for instance, and that was pretty important for his medical discoveries, that people who worked in the mines where mercury was present, natural state, would, if they were exposed to a lot of mercury, would get poisoned by the mercury. But that if they had certain kinds of ailments, certain kinds of infections, some contact of the infected area with the mercury would cure the infection. And that is how eventually Paracelsus came to the conclusion that the then very recent, just beginning horrible epidemics of syphilis, which were brought in from distant lands such as the Americas after the discovery of America, could be successfully treated by way of mercury. And the mercury treatment which Paracelsus devised for syphilis, of course, he didn't know about the nature of the illness causing the pathogenic agents because people didn't know what microbes looked like until after the discovery of the microscope, the little scope, yeah. But they nevertheless formed certain meaningful conclusions often by way of the way the illnesses progressed. They knew there was something there and that this something could be affected and knocked out by mercury. And lest you don't know, or lest you know only partially, the dread venereal disease of syphilis was every bit as pernicious a killer as the immunodeficiency diseases at the present time. It really killed an awful lot of people in Europe. So Paracelsus was an experimentally minded individual. He was an empiricist. His alchemical ideas and his medical ideas were not on the theoretical level for him, but he tested them in various strange places to which scholars and doctors usually did not venture. For 9 full years he walked up and down Germany and other countries in search of knowledge. He dropped out, so he said, he dropped out of learned folly, and he dropped in at the halls of practical wisdom. He was a mystic and a scientist and all of that of a rather outspoken and indeed blunt and militant disposition. He visited Italy, France, Denmark, Sweden, Prussia, Bohemia, Poland, Spain, England, the Balkans, even the dread country of Hungary. He took a job for a while as a barber surgeon in the Dutch army, again, because he wanted to be close to the places where he could study wounds and infections and things of that sort at first hand. He was for a brief time appointed a professor at the University of Basel, where he studied first, but there he scandalized the doctors. He would do such unheard of things as bringing the human feces to the lecture. And this again was considered to be totally out of line by the doctors. Yet, of course, the study of waste is of some use, no doubt, in studying many different ailments. He went to various other places of learning, to the famous university at Nuremberg, where he was in 1530. Nuremberg, incidentally, and this doesn't have to do with Paracelsus, but Nuremberg had the reputation, which I think started in the Middle Ages and is, of course, totally apocryphal, that in Nuremberg they had certain techniques whereby they would employ what is called the Nuremberger funnel, the funnel of Nuremberg. You know what the funnel of Nuremberg is used to? They were still talking about it when I went to school. That in Nuremberg they would poke a hole into your head, and then they would take this magic funnel and pour knowledge into your head, so you didn't have to study. Lazy man's way. I assure you, however, it never existed physically. He went at the invitation of the Duke of Bavaria to the city of Salzburg, which is now in Austria, and there died on the mysterious circumstances on the 24th of September in 1541. When I was in Salzburg back in the 40s, and I imagine it still stands, they would show you the Paracelsus house where he lived and then died. And as I recall, it had sort of a long, very steep stairway, and he fell down that stairway and broke his neck. There was some rumor that he was pushed down the stairway by some of his fellow physicians who were so jealous of him that they didn't want him around. Whether that is true or not, we shall, however, never know. That's about probably enough about the life of the old boy, but he certainly led a somewhat turbulent and exciting life. We need to take a little look at some of his areas of work. His philosophy, which is contained in his works, the works that survived him comprise three massive volumes, each more than 1,000 pages in the original, which he dictated to a disciple of his. They contain a lot of theoretical and practical elements mingled together. Trying to read Paracelsus in the original is a pretty difficult piece of work. You probably do better by reading extracts of his works. In fact, I looked in the bookstore, the Philosophical Research Society. There is a rather nice book, which is The Life of Paracelsus by Franz Hartmann, H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N, translation from a German, and I have it at home both in German and in English. It's a very fine book. You would probably enjoy it. And it's full of quotations marshaled in the right places, which is really the best way to understand Paracelsus. He, along with other alchemists, sort of believed in the coexistence of four realms, of four worlds. And this repeats itself in all of his teachings. When we come to the remedies of illnesses, of the kind of healers, that all constellates itself quite powerfully around this idea. That at the bottom of the ladder, so to say, is the corporeal world. That is where our physical bodies and physical things belong to. And the corporeal world in typical alchemical fashion, and also really in the mode of the commonly accepted philosophy of the times, consists of the four elements of earth, water, fire, and air. So there is the corporeal world, which is ruled by the physical sun, the source of light and heat and vitality. In fact, Paracelsus was wont to say that one important thing is for the physical body is to be exposed to the sun, but not too much. If you try to live pretty much without sunlight, then you will suffer in mind and in body. But if, on the other hand, you are exposed to too much sunlight, then you are also going to get sick. In both of these, I think he anticipated the discoveries of much later medicine. I can certainly testify to the emotional effects of lack of sunshine, because I lived for a number of years in a part of the Austrian Alps, right around, not very far from Salzburg, where Paracelsus died, where, owing to the nature of the terrain, not a ray of sunshine fell on the house wherein I and my family lived for about 4 months out of the year. And I tell you that all other things being equal, when you are that much deprived of sun, you get really depressed. We would take incredibly long walks clear around to the other side of the lake. For any of you want to go there and take a look, it's the Lake of Hallstatt in Austria, an ancient salt mining area, where as much as 6,000 years ago they were already mining salt, the old Celts. A lot of salt in the mountains around there. In any event, also Paracelsus was smarter in that regard than many of the people, including the medical world, I think sort of in the 1930s and the 1940s and around there, where most people thought that the more exposed you were to the sun, the healthier you would be. Now, we know, of course, that that is not the case and that we can get all kinds of things, including skin cancer, melanoma, as the result of that. Anyway, the physical sun, for better or for worse, is sort of the, he said, the energy center of everything physical and also of the physical body. Then the next one up on the scale is the sidereal world. Sidereal means, of course, starry. And that thereby, of course, is meant the world of the planets and the world of the zodiacal constellations. Now, to Paracelsus, again, this was not meant entirely physically, but rather, how should we put it, astrometaphorically, because along with other wise people, both in his time and later on, he took the planets and the signs of the zodiac as, well, how should we put it, as archetypal symbolic powers of the mind. These people, alchemists and similar folk in those days, felt that what we now would call our psychological makeup is heavily influenced by the celestial bodies, or at least is related to them in some mysterious symbolical fashion. It would be difficult for me to believe that Paracelsus was one of these very reductionistic, material-minded astrologers who would say that, I don't know, if Mars is in a bad position in your horoscope at the present moment, well, just don't even go outside the door, or anything of that sort. But on the other hand, he felt with a lot of the other alchemists and hermeticists that in some way we receive our mental, our psychological nature from forces that at least symbolically, if not actually physically, are closely related to the celestial bodies. You know, the symbolism involved in that, which I don't think too many astrologers mention nowadays, because I suppose it would make them look too superstitious. But, you know, the ancient theory was always that we, the spiritual self, somehow originates in a world that is both symbolically and spatially beyond the stars. And so we come through first certain constellations of the zodiac, and then one by one through the seven sacred planets right down to Earth. And that at each one of these stations, as we descend to Earth in a kind of descending space flight, spiritual space flight without rocket ship, we pick up elements of the stars, so that our minds are composed of star stuff. This, again, this sounds weird to people today because we have reoriented ourselves in accordance with the heliocentric system and all kinds of things of that sort. But what is meant, of course, thereby is that we have, well, let's say we have Saturnine qualities, which means that the sort of judgmental and brooding and grumpy part of our psychological disposition is something that we picked up from the planet Saturn. And then the angry and irascible, martial part of our disposition we picked up from the planet, you guessed it, Mars. And so on and so forth. Our amorous disposition from Venus and all of that. So our emotional, psychological makeup, that is the sidereal world within us. And there, he said, a sort of invisible universal sun. which is the second sun, is the central agency. These notions are fairly universal. We know that the Egyptians believed in more than one sun. We know that the Hindus to this day have at least two gods, one associated with the physical sun, who is Surya, and one with the spiritual or psychological sun, who is Savitri. When the Hindus intone the famous salutation of the dawn, which is said to the sun as it rises, the Gayatri, that is addressed to Savitri. Om Tat Savitur Varenyan Bargo Devasya Dimahi Jodoya Pracodoyat Om. And we salute Savitri, our Lord. So it's something like Savitri, a sort of central light, light of the mind, which is not physical, but around which the sidereal bodies, the sidereal part of the human constellates itself. And then, of course, the third one, and the farthest away from us, the spiritual world, world of spirit, which is constellated around the spirit of God, which is the divine sun. Now, along with some other alchemical and magical scholars of his day, certainly Paracelsus was also deeply involved with and greatly interested in the power of the imagination. And I'll give you another little quotation here, which comes from Manly Hall's book, but which quotes Paracelsus. Paracelsus was one of the first to study the effect of the imagination on the mental and physical life of the human being. Many of his observations anticipated the findings of modern psychology. The word imagination has the same root as the word magic, M-A-G, mag, as. And the power of imagery can be developed for the accomplishment of a variety of purposes. Paracelsus wrote, "Determined imagination is the beginning of all magical operations." You need to remember that magic and alchemy, along with perhaps Kabbalah, Hermetic philosophy, were not considered to be really all that separate. People who studied one studied the other. The imaginative power is strengthened and sustained by will. Faith must confirm the imagination and set it in a proper course, for faith establishes the will. In another place, Paracelsus said, "Because men do not perfectly imagine and believe, the result is that the arts are uncertain." So certainly the power of the imagination, the power of the mind, was considered by him as sort of really the extremely important and sort of the fuel of the spiritual life and of all the other disciplines. He was also the first to bring into medical thinking a curious commodity, which makes its appearance from time to time and then after a while is again discarded from our thinking. At the present time, it is mostly discarded, but I wouldn't be amazed if at some point it will reappear again. And that is the importance of magnetism, and in connection with that, actually, of magnets. Some of you will remember in my talk in connection with magic, and also perhaps with alchemy, but certainly with magic, that magnet also has that word, M-A-G, which we find in magic and imagination, and that magnets were considered symbolically sort of important because of the way that they attract iron shavings and thereby get bigger. They came from the island of Magnes. With Paracelsus, however, there was a little bit more to it. Paracelsus felt that there was a force, which for lack of a better word he called magnetic force, which was present in magnets and was present in the earth, more heavily concentrated in some metals than in others. but also present in the human being. So to him, the magnet and the power of the magnet was both symbolic and actual. Here we have a little more on that from Manly Hall's statement. The magnetic philosophy of Paracelsus originated in his thought about the possible use of magnets in the treatment of disease. Up to his time, no one seems to have thought of the magnet as a means of therapy. He applied magnetized substances to various parts of the human body according to certain rules and claimed to have cured a variety of ailments in this manner. Having convinced himself of the reality of magnetic force, he evolved an elaborate philosophy on the subject. All parts of nature are bound together by a magnetic sympathy, he said. Magnetism is an invisible substance which explains how distant bodies may be in sympathy with each other, although not connected in a visible way. Man is bound to the universe by magnetic sympathy. This is possible because each living thing has within it the polarities of all other living things. And you know, of course, that a magnet has a positive and negative pole, for instance. As there are constellations in the sky, so there are smaller constellations in the human brain. And these two orders of stars, differing in magnitude but identical in quality, are united by the sympathy of similarity. There is a magnet within each person by which he draws to himself the qualities appropriate to his disposition and nature. In this way he can draw disease out of space and bind it to himself. The quality of the personality magnet is determined by internal consciousness. I think that is probably enough about that under the time. Let me just indicate that this magnetic philosophy did not totally go out of business. At various times in history, it resurfaced. One person who certainly started a heck of a lot of different things by way of his own ideas about magnetism was the Austrian physician toward the end of the 18th century, Franz Anton Mesmer. Mesmer, who was born sort of in the area of Austria that adjoins Switzerland in the state of Vorarlberg along the Lake Bodensee, was a great student of Paracelsus and developed his magnetic teachings on the basis of the teachings of Paracelsus. Somehow, and don't quite ask me how, because my technical knowledge of how all this proceeded is not all that great, but somehow in the course of his treatments of people with magnets, actual physical magnets, and also by the magnetic force which he said emanated from one human and could be passed on to another, Mesmer developed what today is known as hypnotism. In his days, in the 18th and 19th century, being early 19th century, being called often mesmerism. And so what started as a presumed passing on of magnetic force from one person to the other for the purposes of healing became a technique for the altering of consciousness. People would go into altered states of consciousness called magnetic or hypnotic trances. Now, I don't have the time or the inclination to go into all the details, but this particular way in which Dr. Mesmer hit upon the idea of certain altered states of consciousness had tremendous implications, because from then on, the word hypnosis later on came in by way of a British physician, I think by the name of Baird, who hypnos in Greek means sleep. You know, but people found out that by way of this altered state of consciousness, all kinds of things can happen. For one thing, it can act as an anesthetic. To this day, in places where anesthetics, chemical anesthetics are unavailable in war and so forth like that, doctors have performed operations, physicians, surgeons have performed operations and so forth by anesthetizing people by hypnosis. it can be done. Childbirth, for instance, can be induced by hypnotic suggestion. I've known a gynecologist lady years ago. Her husband was a friend of mine who used to hypnotize women who were, you know, going to have a baby more or less within a particular time. You are going to have your baby at 8 o'clock on Monday the 17th of August. And they delivered the babies just like that. But there was one caveat. He said you had to be pretty careful because if there were complications, the body would still desperately try to deliver the baby. And then problems could arise. So you had to watch it. If there was a complication, then you had to undo the hypnotic suggestion. But interestingly, all of these things came originally from the magnetic philosophy that was originated with Paracelsus, was picked up by Mesmer. Just to complete the circle so I don't leave anything unsaid, other people took the hypnotic techniques into other areas, and out of these developed, believe it or not, psychoanalysis and all of modern depth psychology, because Freud had become enamored with the hypnotic experiments of certain French doctors, particularly Charcot in France, and I don't need to go into the details, but it was on the basis of these that psychoanalysis was developed. The thinking sort of being that just as a hypnotist can suggest to a person certain kinds of symptoms and the person will feel those symptoms even though there is no physical reason for it, there can be a psychological complex within a person that can exercise a hypnotic suggestion that also will cause certain symptoms of what once were called hysterical ailments and things of that sort. And out of this recognition really developed all of modern depth psychology, primarily because Freud did not know how to hypnotize. And so he had to find another way to do this, and that's how the talking cure developed. Other people took it into religious and quasi-religious fields, and hypnotic and self-hypnotic trances became a very important factor in spiritualism, in things that nowadays are called channeling, and in all kinds of things of that sort. All of this, however, started with the magnetizing and the magnetic teachings of Paracelsus. I might as well throw in at this point also that an entirely different medical discipline, much more related to the medicines that Paracelsus was interested in, also originated in the teachings of Paracelsus, and that is homeopathy. Because another doctor, Dr. Hahnemann, a German physician who was a great student of the works of Paracelsus, developed homeopathy on the basis of the teachings of Paracelsus also. And I'm not that conversant with homeopathic theory, but let's say some of the magnetic philosophy of Paracelsus also plays a role there, because the real value of homeopathic medicines is that they are said to have a certain potency which is other than their mere physical chemical constitution. Okay? Of course, alchemy was present in all of these. Paracelsus believed that base substances can be made, for instance, and that was pretty much his own idea, to nourish higher substances by being subjected to a process of change. He said that the human digestive process, for instance, is based on that principle. Our stomach, rather like the Chinese would say, according to Paracelsus, is a kind of an alchemical kitchen. That is where the steady flame of the alchemist burns, and that is where substances, food, are made to nourish the life functions and the life force and the various organs of the body. Physical alchemy always veils a spiritual alchemy, said Paracelsus. One of his metaphors was what he called the soul tree, the tree of psyche. He said the seed of the soul is planted in the human heart. Then the spiritual sun, which is Lumen Dei, of the alchemists, the light of God, the spiritual sun touches this seed in the heart so that it germinates and releases its power. Spiritual aspirations are of the individual are like the fertilizing and the watering of the soul tree. In fact, I think there are some alchemical manuscripts. It sort of dawns on my memory in a vague sort of a way. I have seen pictures like that, where you see a tree coming out of the chest of the individual, and then the birds sit on it and all that sort of thing. So he said, we all have a tree within our heart, but we need to keep nourishing it. So there are two things that nourish the soul tree. Our aspiration, our intentionality, our will, whereby we fertilize and water the soul tree. But the other all-important factor, in accordance with his regard for the sun, is in this case from the spiritual sun, which is the divine sun. It comes from God. Once again, here is the alchemical principle which I mentioned before, and that's what I think people in our secularized world need to remember, that to the alchemist, the transformation process, or let's say here the expansion of the soul, does not come about by purely human means. Alchemists never believed in secular salvation. I don't think anybody ever believed in secular salvation except modern and postmodern people in our own world. The two things are contradictory. Now, that doesn't mean that one has to believe in a God with a long beard who wags his finger at you and punishes you for every little thing. No, that's not the kind of spiritual son that I'm talking about. But that there must be a supernatural and transhuman and transpersonal principle, generally symbolized in alchemy by Mercury, that is the ultimate agency that brings about the transformation. We can't just transform ourselves. We must contribute our share. But then there must be something higher that comes in and that ultimately brings the transformation about. Somewhat along the lines of C.G. Jung's saying, which is more oriented, of course, to psychological transformation, I don't make myself, I happen to myself. And that happening is more than chance, that happening is synchronistic, that happening is transcendental, that happening is divine. So what we need to keep in mind here, that I think these old folk alchemists, and including Paracelsus, were very correct in pointing out, that don't think that these transformations are purely or even primarily rational operations which we can figure out and which we can do and which we can learn purely at the level of our human personality. There always has to be an openness to something greater, and when that comes in, and our own aspiration, our own watering and fertilizing of the soul tree and the divine sun come together, that is when the soul tree grows. It's the same principle that makes the gold and the silver grow in the earth, said Paracelsus. Another interesting little idea of Paracelsus, which he said that he put into practice, is the idea of the homunculus. Now, homo, of course, means man, human, right? Homunculus is a diminutive in Latin. It means sort of little bitty human, homunculus. And the homunculus, according to alchemical teaching, is an artificial human being fashioned by alchemical means. It grows for 40 days in a glass vial, and it must be nourished by vital substances from the body of the living human and also from the mind of the living human. To amplify this idea, Paracelsus employed the words of St. Paul, there is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. Now, I am in no position to say how many actual physical aspects, for instance, of this teaching there may exist. There is all the excitement nowadays, for instance, about embryonic research and the use of embryonic cells for various things. One wonders whether the alchemists might not have had some ideas along these lines. But at the same time, I think a metaphorical, a spiritual meaning is fairly evident. Namely, that there is an inner supernatural man, which must be nourished by the external. That the external substance of the human needs to be used to nourish the internal, the homunculus. And that therefore the homunculus could be looked upon as a product within the human of spiritual transformation. Once again, the parallel with Chinese alchemy is rather close. When we spoke about Western alchemy versus, for instance, Chinese alchemy, some of you will recall, we mentioned that in such alchemical treatises, just to mention some that are available to us, like the Treatise of the Golden Flower, by Richard Wilhelm, which Jung commented on, The Secret of the Golden Flower is the title of the book. It's even pictured within the human. The human is the alchemical vessel, the human body. And within the human body grows another little man envisioned as a little Buddha. He sits there on a lotus right inside of the human. And according to Chinese alchemy, this becomes the container of eternal life. That if we build within ourselves the little golden Buddha with his golden flower, this will carry consciousness once the body falls apart. Well, a similar idea might be indeed in the notion of the homunculus. Now I need to come to some of the specifically medical ideas of Paracelsus. What we are practicing now in our Western world is, of course, what is called allopathic medicine. In allopathic medicine, we have the understanding that there are two main factors in all matters of health and disease, namely the body and its defenses on the one hand, which now is called grandiloquently by the name of immune system. Hardly ever anybody used that term some years ago, but since the coming of AIDS and things like that, now there is a lot of talk, of course, about the immune system. So the body and its immune system on the one hand, and the invading enemy or the armies of pathogenic sickness-causing microbes on the other. These are the two main factors. So a contemporary physician does one of two things or two things together in combination. He tries to stimulate the defenses of the body so that they will fight off the enemies who are always around and are trying to eat us up. And on the other hand, of the medicines themselves fighting the pathogenic agent. So there has to be a stimulation of the way that the body fights off the enemy and then giving maybe some weapons to the body so that the enemy gets killed off. Remember, the discovery of the microorganisms, when one finally could see them, is the one that opened up really all of modern medicine. And that was not available at that time. The origin of the diseases are seen in an alchemical manner. You remember, the alchemists talk about salt, sulfur, and mercury. Now then, salt, in a medical sense, is matter or the physical body. It's considered feminine and receptive and moist, watery. And of course, the body consists of water to a great extent. We know that. Sulfur is the psyche, the sidereal self that we spoke about before, the mind-emotion complex. And then mercury is the spirit. So Paracelsus may be said to have a view that is really quite interesting. He said that the causes of diseases, there are five different types of causes of diseases. And often a disease may have more than one cause. Paracelsus was definitely a believer in multiple causation when it comes to ailments, which I think is a good idea to keep in mind, not only regarding medicine, but other things too. Our minds have a simplifying tendency. We love to fixate on one particular cause of something. Ah, yeah, that's the culprit. Because then if we can somehow feel that we can get rid of that one cause, then everything is okay. But you know, most anything that we encounter in this life, whether it's a disease or anything else, is caused by several factors. Maybe there is one factor that is more prominently represented than the others, but multiple causation is something to be kept in mind. Now, here are the five causes of disease, first by name, then maybe I'll look at them a little bit more in detail if I can. I'll mention the Latin words, but I'm sure that is in one ear and out the other. Ens astrale, which means starry being. By this he means the surrounding influences and conditions primarily of a psychic nature. Our psyche, which is connected with the stars, gets influences from the starry realm. So let's say there is an astrological, astro-psychic causation of illness. Nowadays we would probably primarily call it psychosomatic, namely when psyche reacts on soma, mind reacts on the body. That's one possible cause. Ens veneri, which means the being of poisons, impurities and poisonous substances of a physical nature. So there is psychic environment, which is envisioned as starry, and physical environment, which is envisioned as poisonous. There are toxins, they are poisons in physical life, then as now. So there was very little technology to speak of in the day of Paracelsus, but he felt that poisons there were aplenty. And here again, his research, say in the mines, in the silver mines where mercury was found, quicksilver, and the salt mines and so forth, proved this to him, because he saw how the miners, when exposed to certain things, like exposed to mercury or other poisonous substances, lead or so forth, would be poisoned thereby. The third is maybe a little more difficult to fathom, but I think we can probably unravel that too. This he called ens naturae, being of nature. And the ens naturae, by this he meant not primarily outer nature, like, I don't know, trees and plants and things like that. No doubt there are poisonous plants, but that would go on the poisons. But he said that certain diseases have their origin in certain conditions inherent in the constitution of the human body. So here he put his finger on things that nowadays we may recognize as genetic predispositions. In other words, illnesses that arise out of our own nature. That's what he meant by nature. We are predisposed toward certain illnesses. We are predisposed. We may inherit tendencies and certain illnesses from our ancestors and so forth. Psychological problems and psychological poisons, physical poisons, predispositions of the body. Now there comes ens spirituale, being of spirit. Here we are speaking of, well, a sort of a higher, more subtle, more transcendental aspect of the psyche. One may wonder even whether he may not be talking about things like the deep unconscious. Jung certainly would agree that archetypes can also make us sick. Archetypes may heal us. Archetypes may possess us. So things that come from a deeper center of the psyche, the spiritual functions of the psyche, actually Paracelsus divides into three functions, three units: will, imagination, and memory. Now you can sort of draw conclusions yourself how all of these three or either of them might be involved in pathogenic situations that they might cause illness. Will comes from the German Willen, which is very closely connected with the idea of desire, but it is distinct from ordinary desire. In fact, Paracelsus said, you do not know a tithe of the real power of the will. And he said, when there is ill will in the psyche that causes disease, then the right kind of will can undo it. So it's very important to deal with one's will and see what one really wants. The whole issue of will is a very complex thing. I can't go into it to a great extent. But it's not just a simplistic notion that I want to get well. I will to get well. That's very simplistic. Paracelsus would say you have to learn how to align your will with the greater, the universal spiritual will. And then things work out, let's say, right. And then the last one is probably even more difficult to fathom, ens Dei. That means being of God. So he says some illnesses arise out of the supreme reality, out of the design or the will of the divine. So Paracelsus definitely would not go along with the sort of new thought, new age thinking that is pretty much based on the idea that God wants us to be totally healthy. One wonders if God is omnipotent and why in the heck aren't we totally healthy all the time. If that's what he wants, then that's how it should be. But anyway, it's a complex matter. Paracelsus would say transcendental factors can also be involved. Now, if Paracelsus had been a Hindu, or if he had contact with India, that was, of course, still quite a ways off before even the British set foot on India, he might have repeated the Hindu doctrine of karma, because that would be sort of the equivalent, a transcendental factor over which neither our environment, nor poisons, nor our higher psyche, nor our lower psyche, nor our physical heredity has any control over. Something that comes from a deeper source. So that certain ailments, certain diseases may have this kind of a transcendental origin. What does one do then? Well, one deals with it the best one can, and for the rest one resigns oneself to the will of God. So you might say, oh well, that's what all the fundamentalists say, and that's what all the religious people say, and what's new about that? Well, I don't say it's new. But I would say that, you know, no matter how psychological or how metaphysical our thinking about these matters becomes, you know, some room should be left for that factor which is not only beyond our control, but even beyond our comprehension. If we don't leave some room for that, then we really end up in poor shape. I have met more people in my lifetime who were very involved in this kind of positive thinking type of mode. And you know, I'm not putting that down entirely. There is a place for that. But when it becomes an all-consuming model of reality for the individual, a time will come when that does not apply. In your health, in your life and death, in your life circumstances. All of a sudden this will not work anymore. You won't be able to cure yourself or someone else with positive thinking, with any of these things. And what will you do then? Well, I tell you what most people do. If they really believe in that stuff, then they begin to do something that is really very counterproductive. They begin feeling guilty. I must not be doing something right. I must not be thinking right. That's why it is happening. You know, that's by no means certain. In fact, at a certain point, it's probably very uncertain. So room must be left for this other factor. And then one just has to deal with the situation. I well remember, for instance, a lady whose name some of you may still remember, others may not. She lived her last few years and died here in the 1970s, I believe, in Silver Lake District, the writer and poetess Anais Nin. Anais Nin was an astonishing individual, you know, big intimate friend of Lawrence Durrell, of Henry Miller, of just about everybody and all that. Very interesting person. She died of cancer. And so she was surrounded in the 70s by all this sort of new age coterie, you know. They were all telling her, oh, Anais, you know, you have to visualize your cancer, and then you visualize it shrinking and going away. You know what Anais Nin's answer was? She said, but I don't want to see my cancer. I don't want to visualize my cancer. It's disgusting. It will make me feel worse. And she forgot about it. And I dare say if she visualized it, she probably would have still died. Now, I don't know why I brought that up, but it seemed like a good idea. But the nevertheless, there is a certain point where one has to recognize that there may be factors. Karma, God, this, that, and the other thing, factors that are beyond both our control and our comprehension, that are also involved in illness. In accordance with these five causes of disease, but not exactly correlated with them, you know, five is also a big alchemical number, because there are the four elements plus the quintessence, the mysterious fifth element. And so he also said that there are five kinds of healers. I'll go through these quickly. The first of these he called naturales, the naturals. These are people who employ physical remedies which act as an opposite, an opposing force to the illness. Those who oppose one kind of influence by another, using the principle of polarities and balances. To a certain extent, I would say some of the current allopathic medicine fits this. Then he said, specificity, those who employ certain remedies which experience has shown to act as specific remedies for a specific condition. Now, in modern medicine, the little that I know about it, you know, most medications that you take are general medications, although they have maybe a specific application. But they act upon the body more in a general manner. Then there are some that are specific. One of the examples that they always used to point out in classes and so forth about medicine is the discovery of quinine. Well, quinine is a specific for fever and for malaria. So there are specifics and general medicine. So people who administer specific remedies for specific conditions. Then the third one is caracterales, as he called them in Latin, those who employ powers of the mind, of the character, acting upon the will and imagination of the patient. So here are the mind cures, the faith healers, but also positive attitudes, things induced by the good bedside manner of a physician and so forth, which should never be put down. I'm not a physician, but let's say I certainly have seen a lot of improvement in the conditions of ill people just because of the positive attitude and the bedside manner of the physician. And I'm afraid that with all the technologization of medicine, there is less and less of that. We depend more and more on technology, and the doctors don't find it incumbent upon themselves to show a certain kind of psychological attitude, which could be a great help, of course, to the patient. So those are the caracterales. Then there are the spirituales, as he says, those who are able to align themselves with some of the spiritual powers that are deeper than the ordinary mind. You can see the connection of that with some of the causes. So we might almost say here it would be a healer who deals at the archetypal level. Something comes to my mind in connection with that, and the last one, probably two, that I read in some scriptures of an old medieval mystical group in France, the Cathars, who said that, writing about Jesus. And they said, Jesus was a good healer because he did not heal the body. He healed the soul. And when the soul was healed, then the body became healed. Now we, of course, don't know what went on in the time of Jesus, but certainly such things are possible. And then finally he said the fideles, the faithful ones, through whom miraculous works are performed, by which he meant that these are people who can align themselves so perfectly with a transcendental, a divine power and a divine will, that through them healing of the body takes place. Once again, I think what we need to remember is that unlike so many people in scientific medical field at various times in history, and among all sorts of people today, Paracelsus had shown this remarkable many-sidedness and flexibility in recognizing so many different classifications of the potential causes of illness, and also so many different ways and methods of dealing with illness. And he didn't say that four of these were wrong and one was right, or three of them were wrong and the rest of them were right, or whatever. But he said that they all are useful. They all are appropriate at certain times and under certain conditions. And that a good healer is really the one who recognizes as to which approach, a primarily physical one, a primarily mental one, a primarily spiritual one, or a totally transcendental one, and so forth, is appropriate to this particular condition, which sort of makes tremendous demands, I think, on the intuition, obviously, of the physician. But also indicates for us, I think, the need for a broad-mindedness and flexibility in this area. And I think, if I may say so without intruding into the field of medicine, because I'm not one of these people, I just become interested in spiritual things, now I'm the great one to pontificate about medicine. I don't do that. But let's see, if there were more of this kind of flexibility and open-mindedness, not only on the part of the medical profession, but just as much on the part of people in the alternative field too, because I think that there is an utterly unfortunate and deplorable one-sidedness and dogmatism regarding health that I find all over the place. For instance, just as a little example of it, just one that I thought of, it's not particularly important to me or perhaps to anyone else. In New Zealand, for instance, chiropractors and doctors of medicine live together in the greatest of harmonies. At least they did about 10 years ago when I was there. And what happens is that the medical doctors, when they find that somebody has a back condition and so forth, where chiropractic treatment would be a benefit, refer the patient to a chiropractor. And the patient profits, and both doctors profit, the MD and the DC, both make a living, and nobody fights. Seems like a rather ideal situation. But at the same time, the chiropractors don't play MD either. They don't say, oh, all you got to do is come to me and have your back manipulated and take a few vitamins and you're going to be just the healthiest in the world. So there is a recognition of the particular fields, and it's really interesting that someone in the 16th century had such a wide view regarding these various possibilities and certainly still knew the relationship of the strictly physical with the spiritual. So I think at that point I will conclude my ruminations, and I hope that this served as a little introduction to you on Paracelsus, and maybe you can look into some of the literature. Mr. Manley Hall, I think, also has a little pamphlet-sized book on Paracelsus. Then he has a good chapter of Paracelsus in his book Pathways of Philosophy and The Life of Paracelsus by Hartmann. All of these would be probably of interest to you. And I hope that this has been of interest to you, and hope to see you next time.
Copyright MMI by BC Recordings, catalog number 300103. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's gnosis.org.